7. More or less exact to the middle of that page. 299 is the line number, if you have the line numbers. And when the slow rhyme of expanding years and the rich murmurous swarm work of the days had honey-packed her sense and filled her limbs, as she was growing up from girlhood to childhood to girlhood, it looked as if her entire body was filled with this kind of a nectarous sweetness. Accomplishing the moon orb of her grace, self-guarded in the silence of her strength, her solitary greatness was not less. Nobody dared to be very close to her. Everybody admired her, but felt here was somebody who was too great for us to be on familiar terms. But at the same time, they couldn't help admiring her, her physical beauty, her inner beauty. Nearer the Godhead to the surface pressed, a sun replacing childhood's nebula, sovereign in a blue and lonely sky, upward it rose to grasp the human scene. The strong inhabitant turned to watch her field. A lovelier light assumed her spirit brow, and sweet and solemn grew her musing gaze. Celestial human deep warm slumberous fires woke in the long fringed glory of her eyes, like altar burnings in a mysteried shrine. Out of those crystal windows gleamed a will that brought a large significance to life. So you can see how Sri Aurobindo has constructed even this part very, very carefully. And then on page 358, he describes her, a nectarous haloed moon, her passionate heart, middle of that line, middle of that page, line 324. A nectarous haloed moon, her passionate heart, loved all and spoke no word and made no sign, but kept her bosom's rapturous secrecy, a blissful, ardent mood and voiceless world. Now, her childhood page 362, beginning of that page. A boundless knowledge greater than man's thought, a happiness too high for heart and sense. Locked in the world and yearning for release, she felt in her. Waiting as yet for form, it asked for objects around which to grow, and nature strong to bear without recoil the splendor of her native royalty, her greatness and her sweetness and her bliss, her might to possess and her vast power to love. Earth made a stepping stone to conquer heaven. So she looked like a kind of stepping stone. You use her and from there the next step is heaven itself. That's the kind of being she was as she was growing into her early youth. The soul saw beyond heaven's limiting boundaries, met a great light from the unknowable, and dreamed of a transcendent action sphere. Aware of the universal self in all, she turned to living hearts and human forms, her soul's reflections, complements, counterparts, the close outlying portions of her being, divided from her by walls of body and mind, yet to her spirit bound by ties divine, overcoming invisible hedge and mask defense, and the loneliness that separates soul from soul. She wished to make all one immense embrace, that she might house in it all living things, raised into a splendid point of seeing light, out of division's dense, inconscient cleft, a and make them one with God and world and her. As she was growing up, as she was seeing more and more people, her one thought was to embrace the whole world, as it were, in her love and offer it to the Divine. That was what she was feeling. Well, here is a fairly long description on page 364, what people felt about Savitri. Those of you who still remember as little children seeing the mother around you here, probably will find these lines very nostalgic. They bring back to you the very mother's presence. This is page 364, middle of that page, line number 190. A being they loved, whose bounds exceeded theirs. People who were around her in the ashram or whatever, they could see that here was a being who was much vaster and larger than themselves. A being they loved, whose bounds exceeded theirs. Her measure they could not reach, but bore her touch. Nobody could ever felt they could be anywhere near the mother. Answering with the flower's answer to the sun. See, they were her, to her sun, they were sunflowers. They were little flowers answering to her touch, to the touch of her grace. So they all blossomed in the warm sunshine of her love and care. They gave themselves to her and asked no more. One greater than themselves, too wide for their ken, their minds could not understand nor wholly know. Their lives replied to hers, moved at her words. They felt a Godhead and obeyed a call. Answered to her need and did her work in the world. Their lives, their natures moved, compelled by hers. As if the truth of their own larger selves put on an aspect of divinity to exalt them to a pitch beyond their earths, they felt a larger future meet their walk. Everybody felt it was divine to live around her, to be molded by her. Everybody was convinced that she was preparing them to meet a great divine future. There was no doubt in anybody's mind. She held their hands. She literally did many times and guided people. She held their hands. She chose for them their paths. For somebody embroidery, for somebody making agarbattis, for somebody teaching children, for somebody something else. And everybody felt very blissful. She held their hands and she chose for them their paths. They were moved by her towards great unknown things. Faith drew them and the joy to fulfill themselves hers. Their greatest life fulfillment was that they all belonged to the mother. They lived in her. They saw the world with her eyes. Some turned to her against their nature's bent. This has also happened. But I am no expert in ashram affairs, so I will keep this part away. I don't know enough about it to say that, but I know this also happened. Some turned to her against their nature's bent. They just couldn't help being mesmerized by her presence. Their nature spent was somewhere else. But in her presence, they turned to her. Divided between wonder and revolt. something in there, said, who is this mother? She is a great dictator, etc., etc. In the wonder of her love, of her grace, so divided between wonder and revolt, drawn by her charm and mastered by her will, possessed by her, striving to possess, impatient subjects that their tied, longing hearts, hugging the bonds close of which they most complained, it's also there, murmured at a yoke, they would have wept to lose. Murmured at a yoke, they would have wept to use, to lose. The splendid yoke of her beauty and her love. Others pursued her with life's blind desires. Some people were convinced this is the life's wish-fulfilling tree. This is the Kamadhenu. You ask anything and she will give it. And so she pursued her. Others pursued her with life's blind desires. And claiming all of her as their lonely own. Why did mother smile? A little wider smile gave to X and not to me. Shri Aurobindo had to write several letters to explain the fact that mother did smile at you today doesn't mean that she was angry with you. She was probably mentally preoccupied with something else. Why did mother give him two cards and gave me only one card? Everything. So everybody, you see, even when love turns to the vital love turns to God, it still wants to have a monopoly on God. And so, even whenever they find it, this human nature doesn't immediately change. It's only struggling against it, slowly and gradually you begin to realize this is not something you can make your own. This is, the Supreme Mother can't be exclusively yours. The whole world is waiting for her love, her grace. But people don't realize it, and the Divine knows it, and puts up with it for a while. All this has happened. Others pursued her with life's blind desires and claiming all of her as their lonely own, hastened to engross her sweetness meant for all. Her sweetness is meant for all of us. As earth claims light for its lone separate need, demanding her for their sole jealous clasp, they asked from her movements boundless like their own, and to their smallness craved a like response. If we are small, we'll be happy if only the mother also made a small response. Smallness, narrowness. No, it's very clear. Sri Aurobindo knew very, very few women in the world. He was all alone in London. For many years, it was not the modern London, his London was different. Then he came back here and he found that his mother was not in good health, his father had died. So he went to Baroda, and the only companions he had in Baroda was Kalidas and Bhavabhuti and Vyasa and Valmiki. He was engaged in reading all this. And saw Mridalini, fell in love with her at first sight. The great romantic Sri Aurobindo was. But the Divine didn't want him to fulfill that destiny. It raised him up soon after his marriage. But he never forgot Mridalini, never. Even after he became a great yogi, he kept track of her. He gave her what he could have given her, kept giving it. And Mridalini said, I want to take initiation from this Maharaj and that Maharaj. She said, no need. I am taking full responsibility for your spiritual progress, did that. He never forgot her. But he didn't know her very well. In Baroda in those days, there are many friends from Baroda, it's a lovely place, you get very good sweets and basundi and so on. But the one thing they never had in those days was enough rain. I'm talking about the last decade of the last century. Not last century, the century before the last one. 1890s, there was, you know, very often water famine, water scarcity in Baroda. And so, these people, all Bhadralok from Bengal, so Sri Aurobindo said, don't come here, we don't get enough water. So, she might have spent a short period of time here and there with her, but he didn't know her very well. Then he came away here, and his companions were Nalnida, Amrita, etc., etc. So this must be the mother on whom this description is built, because she is the only one she knew, he knew. And so, there can be no, you don't need a pandit to do research. This is the original, and he describes her here, and I will give you other examples as we go along. Let me finish this and let's then take a break for coffee or tea. They asked from her movements bounded like their own, and to their smallness craved a like response, or they repined that she surpassed their grip, and hoped to bind her close with longing's cords, or finding her touch desire too strong to bear, they blamed her for a tyranny they loved, shrank into themselves as from too bright a sun, yet hankered for the splendor they refused. Angrily enamored of her sweet passionate ray, the weakness of their earth could hardly bear, they longed but cried out at the touch desired, inapt to meet divinity so close, intolerant of a force they could not house, some drawn unwillingly by her divine sway, endured it like a sweet but alien spell, unable to mount to levels too sublime, they yearned to draw her down to their own earth, or forced to center round her the passionate lives, they hoped to bind to their hearts human needs, her glory and grace that had enslaved their souls. Let us take a as in earlier years, this year too will be holding the final session, Savitri Bhavan, on the afternoon of 5th March, and the transport arrangements will be as follows. From tomorrow, those of you who are interested in joining us at Savitri Bhavan, please write, give your names here in the first room in this society office, and get a token from the lady there. Give your name, take a token. And this token will entitle you for a free ride to Auroville and back. And the first bus will leave from the post office, ashram post office, at 3 o'clock. And the last bus at 3:30. They probably will give us 4 buses. So first bus leaves at 3, last bus at 3:30. They are asking us not to include a visit to Matri Bhavan as a part of this visit, because that makes it very confused and you just keep running up and down, and at the end of the day, we have touched Matri Bhavan, that's all you get. So this is not a part, Matri Bhavan is not a part of this program. Sorry, Matri Mandir, not Matri Bhavan, Matri Mandir. Now, after the talk, there will be some refreshments. Normally people just gulp them and run to Matri Mandir, you don't have to do it. And there is also an exhibition the photographs in Savitri Bhavan. Savitri Bhavan has expanded in recent years. They have acquired a fairly good library, etc. So we get to know Savitri Bhavan a little more. And then the first bus for return journey will leave at 5:30. The talk will be from 4 to 5. And from 5 to 5:30 is a little time you have for your refreshments, etc. Those who want to linger a little longer can do until 6 o'clock, because the last bus will leave at 6 o'clock. Now, when I was reading out to you some passages from this little biography of the mother, there was a reference to her natural feel for the animal world, for trees, birds and so on. There is also reference to it here on page 366, line 265, the middle of that page. Page 366, line 265, which is the middle of that page. The force in her drew earth's subhuman brutes, cats. There is a story of a stray dog too, who struggled very hard to have a darshan of the mother. It's all recorded in various places. And so, the subhuman brood, animals below the human level of animals, the subhuman brood, the force in her drew earth's subhuman broods, and to her spirit's large and free delight, she joined the ardent-hued magnificent lives of animal and bird and flower and tree. You know the great intimacy, closeness she had with the world of flowers. As a result, a new discipline, as it were, an occult mystical discipline called flowers and their spiritual significance, a whole new thing has developed, and it's a good way to become sensitive to flowers, and through flowers we are generally very crude in our consciousness. Flowers are what make us softer and mellower and more responsive. And all over the country now there are people who organize flower shows of various kinds on various themes. All this the mother subsequently encouraged, and there is here a reference to that as well. Now, on page 372, this is now Savitri, no more a girl, but she is now a young woman. Page 372, last 8-10 lines on that page, line number 131. Her brow, a copy of clear, unstained heavens, was meditation's pedestal and defense. The very room and smile of musing space, its brooding line, infinity's symbol curve. Sri Aurobindo describes young Savitri's face, and he says, her brow, a copy of clear, unstained heavens, was meditation's pedestal and defense. The very room and smile of musing space, its brooding line, infinity's symbol curve. Amid her tresses, cloudy multitude, her long eyes shadowed as by wings of night. Under that moon-gold forehead's dreaming breath, were seas of love and thought that held the world. Marveling at life and earth, they saw truths far. Now this is young Savitri. Now this leads us on to that great moment when Ashwapati hears a disembodied voice which reminds him of the great destiny which is awaiting Savitri. Since it's a great passage, I think there is no harm in drawing your attention to it. This is on page 370, very well known page, 10th passage, 4th line from the top. As we have seen, Savitri has grown into a matchless beauty. Her inner being comes through very transparently, clearly through all her physical movements. People adore her, worship her, but nobody feels that he is competent enough to get closer to her, more intimate to her. And so Ashwapati finally decides to send her out into the world to choose her life's companion. But before that, Ashwapati himself is reminded of the great destiny of Savitri. So line 4, O force compelled, fate driven, earth born race, O petty adventurers in an infinite world, and prisoners of a dwarf humanity, how long will you tread the circling tracks of mind around your little self and petty things? But not for a changeless littleness were you meant, not for vain repetition were you built. Out of the immortal substance you were made, your actions can be swift revealing steps, your life a changeful mold for growing gods. A seer, a strong creator is within. The immaculate grandeur broods upon your days. Almighty powers are shut in nature's cells. A greater destiny waits you in your front. This transient earthly being, if he wills, can fit his acts to a transcendent scheme. He who now stares at the world with ignorant eyes, hardly from the inconscient night aroused, that look at images and not at truth, can fill those orbs with an immortal sight. Yet shall the Godhead grow within your hearts. You shall awake into the spirit's air and feel the breaking walls of mortal mind and hear the message which left life's heart dumb and look through nature with sun-gazing lids and blow your conch shells at the eternal's gate. Authors of earth's high change, to you it is given to cross the dangerous spaces of the soul and touch the mighty mother stark awake and meet the omnipotent in this house of flesh and make of life the million-bodied one. The earth you tread is a border screened from heaven. The life you lead conceals the light you are. It's a long passage, goes on all over next page and ends on page 372. I will read the last few lines. Only a little lifted his mind screen, the wise who know see but one half of truth, the strong climb hardly to a low-peaked height, the hearts that yearn are given 1 hour to love. His tale half told, falters the secret bard. The gods are still too few in mortal forms. The gods are still too few in mortal forms. Well, this is a voice that Ashwapati hears, and then following that is a fairly long description of what Savitri looks like in her physical form, the inner form, etc., that is described. But I won't go into it. I will give you another description which shows us Savitri at a later point in time. Now this is Savitri as a young woman, and soon after this the story advances. Savitri sets out on a quest. In this year-long quest, she finally meets up Satyavan. And there is this episode where Satyavan and Savitri discover each other, understand the meaning of each other's life, they get married, etc. And then Savitri comes back, reports this to her father, and at that moment in the father's court they have a visitor. This is Narad, the Devarshi Narad himself, who commutes between Vaikuntha and the earth. That's the general belief. And when Savitri arrives there, Savitri's father himself doesn't know what has happened, what has transpired during that year. In those days it was not customary to send letters or email to say day-to-day developments, what was happening where. And so Savitri's father himself says to Narad, I don't know what has happened during the year. She left last year at this time, she has come back. She knows best. And then Savitri reveals that she has found Satyavan and tells exactly who Satyavan is. And she says, this is done. I have met him. We have found each other. This is done. No further negotiations. And then, of course, Savitri's father immediately sees, being a great yogi, Ashwapati is a great yogi, he sees what it is. As soon as Satyavan's name is mentioned, he sees a dark cloud chasing Satyavan. And then immediately after the dark cloud, there is a light that comes and dispels this cloud. So Satyavan's father sees that there is a danger to his life, but this will ultimately be cleared up. That is what Ashwapati sees as a yogi. But yogis are not supposed to go around telling what they have seen or what they have experienced. These are very sacred, very intimate to you. You have to keep them close to you. So Ashwapati doesn't say anything. But Savitri's mother, her name is Malavi, she is ecstatic because that's a moment when her daughter has found someone she fancies and she wants to get married to him. And this is a great moment in every mother's life. And she is very happy that Narad has arrived at an auspicious time so that we can obtain Narad's blessings on this union. And she prays to Narad to give his blessings. Narad, of course, has come to give his blessings, but he has also come for another purpose. His purpose is to steal the will of Savitri against a miscarriage of fate's plan. Fate has planned. What is it? Fate has planned? Fate has planned that death must come to Savitri's own private chambers. Knock at the door of her bedroom. Only then death becomes an existential problem. For Savitri, death is not a philosophical problem to be solved in a university senate hall or in a debating room. It's a personal problem. Until it becomes a personal problem, she won't rise against her. So this is the plan of the Divine, that Savitri should meet Satyavan, Savitri should get married to him, and then she will then only be in a position to confront and fight death. And Narad comes, and Narad blesses them, but from what he says, Savitri's mother feels that he is holding back something crucial which she would like to know. And Narad, you know, I don't know whether you know Narad. I have known him right from my childhood. All these people, village minstrels, kirtankars, harikatha people, they would come in the villages to tell us stories about Bhagavat and Puran, etc. Normally the stories would be interesting, sometimes they are not interesting, but however interesting, uninteresting the episode, as soon as Narad's name is mentioned, you'll all sit up, because Narad as our childhood mind saw him, the mischief maker. He ultimately, what he does is, wherever he sees an opportunity for a higher reconciliation, he prompts people to rise, and when they rise, they find their enemies. But through this confrontation, they achieve a higher reconciliation. That is Narada's job, to see a seed for a higher reconciliation. But this reconciliation cannot come except through struggle on both sides. And that's a part. This is Narada's job, so Narada is there, and Narada is waiting for Savitri's mother to ask him, please tell me the whole truth. He has come to give the whole truth, but he makes it look as if it was not his intention, but because you have asked me to give you the whole truth, I'm sorry, I have to give it to you. That's the kind of, you know, PRO job that Narada can do. And then she insists, Savitri's mother insists, please tell us what's going to happen, and Narada says, Satyavan is a young man of exceptional qualities, heart and head, very handsome, etc., etc. But there is only one problem. What is it? This day returning Satyavan must die. There is only 1 year to live. And then, of course, as you know, Savitri's mother tries to dissuade Savitri from sticking on to this decision, asks her to go out once again. Savitri refuses. We won't go into all that at the moment, for reasons I will mention a little later. And then Savitri sticks to her decision, and Narada also says, this is an exceptional quality in this young woman, that once she has decided, her will cannot be defeated even by death. This is an exceptional woman, he says. This is Vyasa's Mahabharata, but Sri Aurobindo translates it in his own way. Finally, Savitri and Satyavan get married formally, and Savitri returns to Satyavan's hermitage. There they spend a whole year, and towards the end of that year, this year, how she spends that year, is described in Canto 1 of Book 7. We won't look at it at the moment. And towards the end of that period, she undergoes certain austerities, which are described in the Mahabharata legend as the Triratra vow. 3 days and 3 nights, she has to perform certain austerities, which Sri Aurobindo has converted into Savitri's Yoga. Goes on for about 100 pages. We'll look at that part in some detail a little later. Now, all this background is necessary for you to appreciate the next passage I'm going to read out. Now, after this, Savitri has gone through all this yoga. Finally, the day on which Satyavan was to die, that day dawns. And that morning, how did Savitri look? This is a picture that Sri Aurobindo has given us. We are now looking at page 352 and so on, which is a midpoint. Savitri has yet to meet Satyavan, Savitri has yet to undergo her yoga, all these things are yet to happen. But we are on page 355, 356 and so on. But we have to go back in the text to page 14 to say what happens next. And it is here that many people feel confused about the structure of Savitri. In fact, in my discussion this time, I began at the chronological beginning of the story. The chronological beginning of the story was Ashwapati's yoga. Chronologically, it begins with Ashwapati undertaking the yoga. Then this begins, Ashwapati's yoga begins in Canto 3 of Book 1. Canto 3 of Book 1. And it goes on and on and on. And we come to a point when Savitri has performed the yoga and is waiting for that day to come about, and suddenly we have to go to Canto 2. This is, you know, trying to keep the old unities of time and place and space. This is time and theme, all this Sri Aurobindo is doing. In fact, if you really look at it, Savitri, the story of one day. Everything happens in one day. The action begins with the dawn of the day on which Satyavan was to die and ends late evening of that day. That's about all. It's only less than 24 hours. All the action takes place in less than 24 hours. But if you look at the ground covered by Sri Aurobindo, it covers the whole of Ashwapati's life. And in trying to describe Ashwapati's journey through the worlds, we go back 15 billion back, 15 billion years ago when the Big Bang took place. So from that Big Bang, how evolution gradually, slowly went on until you had from dead matter, from creation, from chaos to creation, from creation to the world that we see. And in the world that we see, slowly and gradually, greenery comes, vegetation comes, lower forms of life appear, more and more complex forms of life appear, then come birds and animals and monkeys and apes, then come human beings. All this Sri Aurobindo has described, although the action takes place in less than 24 hours. But from time to time, by using this flashback technique, he goes wherever he wants to go. He wants to go back from the beginning of creation until this point. And so, this is the magic of an artist's art. You know, he can compress time past, time future, time present, all in a way. But actually, it's only the story, action takes place in one day. Now, in Canto 1,